What does the word architecture conjure up in your mind? Do you think of starchitects like Rem Koolhaas or the late Zaha Hadid and their spectacular skyscrapers, mega stadiums and designer homes for the rich? You probably don't think of architects putting on hard hats and flak jackets and working as first responders in the world's disaster zones. Yet that's exactly what has been happening. A new breed of architects has emerged in recent years working in a new field. Variously described as humanitarian architecture, activist architecture, and disaster relief architecture. These pioneering architects fly out to redesign and rebuild communities in the wake of wars, earthquakes, and tsunamis around the globe. And we're fortunate to be joined by two of these incredible people tonight. Eric Kessel is the Special Projects Director for the Curry Stone Foundation and a visiting lecturer at the University of California, Berkeley. And he joins us via Skype from Kigali. And Yasmin Lari, Pakistan's first female architect and one of the world's leading builders of disaster shelters, is on the phone from Karachi. Welcome to LNL, Yasmin and Eric.
Thanks, Paul. Good to be here.
Thank you, and greetings from Pakistan, from Karachi.
Eric, if I can begin with you, how did you come to be involved in disaster relief work?
Serendipitously. After undergraduate, I had worked in commercial practice for a few years, and then I went back to get my master's, and Hurricane Katrina struck the United States while I was in the middle of my program. And I'm not sure there was anything remarkable about what I did. Nearly 1 million Americans went down to the Gulf Coast to volunteer their time, and I was one of them. And I think in my experience there, I got to know architecture on a completely different level. I got to understand it and its relationship to poverty and inequality and social justice and its relationship to life itself, how good architecture saves lives and bad architecture costs them. So I never looked back. Once I started doing that, I never returned to commercial practice.
And Yasmin, you began your career in Pakistan designing, I understand, state-of-the-art buildings in the corporate sector. How did you go from designing giant glass and steel monoliths like the Pakistan State Oil House to making disaster shelters out of earth and bamboo?
Well, you know, what happened, Paul, actually, I had my practice for the longest time. And as you rightly say, I was designing for all kinds of things, really. Corporate architecture, but also a lot of housing as well. And my interest had always been in using, you know, sustainable materials and so on. And I'd done quite a bit of low-income housing as well and so on. But I retired in the year 2000. I thought I should give up architecture and now concentrate on writing books. And also doing a lot of conservation work, heritage conservation. And then, of course, the 2005 earthquake happened. And as with Eric, what happened with me was that, like everybody in Pakistan, we all rushed to the area where something like 80,000 people had lost their lives and 300,000 families had got displaced. And I did not know whether I could do anything. I'd never done this kind of work. But, you know, once I got there, I felt, you know, this was something I really wanted to do. And I'm still, you know, I'm there today. I'm still doing it. So it's been a long journey, but it's been very, very interesting and very rewarding work, actually.
So what are the most urgent architectural needs in Pakistan today? And how are you addressing them or attempting to address them through your work today?
Well, you see, the problem with Pakistan today is that we have very high level of poverty. We are among the few states, a few countries where we keep on getting recurring disasters. Almost every year we are hit either by floods or by earthquakes. And so we really have to be ready. So disaster preparedness is something we must really be following. And what I believe in is that we really have to now adopt a rights-based, holistic approach to deal with shelter, with water, with sanitation, with stoves for women, and you know, all kinds of environmental things that we have to do with plantation and so on and so forth. It's really a whole package we should be looking at. And this is what we are trying to do now, is to work, and I only work with in mud and lime and bamboo. I don't use any other materials anymore, which I did earlier, before 2000. And I have this luxury now to be able to really use these materials in so many different ways. Because this is what, especially with mud and earth, this is what common people actually build with. So it's very interesting to totally, you know, change from using, you know, materials that were highly energy consumptive, like steel and concrete, and now using really very sustainable green materials. And so it's been a huge journey of learning as well, actually.
Yes, and materials that have a low carbon footprint as well. Eric, if I could come back to you, you were involved in rebuilding work in Port-au-Prince after the earthquake that devastated Haiti in 2010, and you also worked in Japan in the wake of the tsunami in 2011. I think for many listeners, it's easy to understand what doctors and aid workers contribute in the aftermath of natural disasters, but what role do architects perform in disaster zones? And is this work that you are trained for when you go through university training and learning to be an architect?
Well, to the last question first, no. I don't think anything can prepare you really to work in a disaster zone except for doing it. And I think Yasmin would agree. You know, you have to get on the ground and experience that. In terms of what architects do in disaster zones, they form, you know, both a first responder and a last responder in terms of what they contribute to that arena. In the first response, there's always the immediate questions of shelter and, you know, how do we get people housed and how do we get things operational again? And then there's the question of how do we rebuild in such a way that the disaster will not reoccur? How do we rebuild using more sustainable materials? How do we rebuild using more resilient strategies so that the next earthquake doesn't bring about similar consequences? So the involvement in a disaster zone for an architect is not an immediate relief effort sort of thing where you fly in for 2 weeks and do some work and then leave. You're there for years or decades in some cases, rebuilding these places. So I think, you know, for a general audience, the way to think about it is that, you know, architecture performs a lot of functions in our life. You know, buildings are the first line of defense in our public health system. You know, buildings are the way that we establish equity. You know, we own property and we can take out loans against it and send our children to school. Buildings are how we generate commerce, right? We open a store and that allows commerce to restart and regenerate and allows communities to free themselves from dependency on foreign aid. So architecture actually plays a lot of roles in our daily lives, and all of those roles are disrupted in the event of a disaster. So that's a lot of what a humanitarian architect does, is try and kickstart those engines and use architecture as a vehicle to restart those processes.
There is that adage that applies to foreign aid, that if you give a man a fish, he'll eat for a day, but if you teach him to fish, he'll eat for a year, he'll eat potentially forever. Is there an element of that to the work that you're doing as an architect in a disaster zone?
There's certainly an element of that. I think the cynical view is that, you know, for the aid industry, if you give a man a fish, then you still have a job next year because he's going to need another fish and you can justify another budget, another program, and et cetera. So there's a tension going on, I think, in the aid industry between people who, you know, want to teach development through architecture or other means and people who just want to, you know, provide goods and shelter as a form of aid. They're not wrong. They need to sort of work in complementarity. But I can say from my personal practice, I've always favored long-term development. You know, you want these communities to be reconstituted as the sort of communities that you would want to live in. So, no, I mean, I think in a way, many of the problems in the Global South have been engendered by a world aid community that sees fit to only give fish rather than teach fish.
And Yasmin, you're also a big believer in teaching communities affected by natural disasters to become self-reliant rather than depending on aid. How do you go about this?
Well, you know, what's happened since 2005 and what I witnessed was that the whole UN system and the INGOs had devised something called clusters. So there was a siloed approach, which meant that if, for instance, UN Habitat would be doing housing, then they will not be doing water. And if, let's say, UNICEF was doing water and sanitation, they would not be doing plantation, and so on and so on. So with the result that a lot of funding actually was directed towards the people who were supposedly, you know, who really had been affected, but they were treated really as victims, which meant that you really never got them to be partners in the whole process. You were actually giving out largesse. And that was a colonist approach, like a paternalistic approach, which does not develop the capacities of the people. Another thing that I found was that women were invariably left behind because nobody could reach them because, you know, with Pakistan society, it's conservative and women do not come out. Mm. So they were left to just fend for themselves. And I thought that we had to change that. So we've devised now what I call, and I don't know whether you'll agree, but it's called humanistic barefoot social architecture. We're talking with people who really have nothing and to see how you can bring them up and how you can make them self-reliant. So women play a very important role in whatever I do today. Mm. So we try to bring them up, empower them, see how they can do a lot of things, and they really can lead a lot of efforts.
It's a lovely term, barefoot social architecture. It's a beautifully evocative term, Yasmin. I mentioned earlier you were Pakistan's first female architect. I wonder what your experience has been like working as a woman in your field.
That's a very interesting question. Women are not supposed to be doing very much, at least not the time that, you know, I had graduated. And look, I'm talking of last century, okay? I graduated in 1963, so I've been working since then. And but I have to say that, you know, being educated, I felt very privileged. I felt that, you know, I had a lot of advantages. So there were problems, of course, but I think that happens to every young professional, and I think that happened to me as well. But because of the privileged background, I think it was not such a big deal, actually. I think what we need here in Pakistan and countries like mine is to help women who are really disadvantaged, and that's where the problem is. I think people like myself really have not had much of a problem, even though, you know, it's a society which is highly conservative. I managed to do a lot of things. I got a lot of help all the way from everybody, actually. So I can't say, I don't have any complaints, I have to say, actually, Paul.
Mm. Eric, with natural disasters such as floods, earthquakes, tsunamis, affecting more and more of the world's population, how do you see climate change and the fact that there may well be more and more of these extreme weather events? How does that affect your work and architecture in the future?
Dramatically. I think there's no doubt that climate change is accelerating, and, you know, we have reams of data that, you know, the number and frequency and severity of worldwide disasters is increasing. And not linearly. I mean, it's a banana curve in terms of the destruction that's being wrought as a result of climate change. That's problematic because, you know, when we design buildings, we're typically designing them for, you know, 20, 30, 40 years in the future, or at least theoretically we should be. So a lot of the ways that our cities are organized and their buildings are built were not built around the idea that we would have these extreme climate events every day. So, you know, one of the things that I talk to my students about is, you know, what does the United States start to look like when we have a Hurricane Sandy once a year, or we have, you know, a 50-year drought in California? A couple of weeks ago, Sweden, I believe, was battling forest fires that had broken out north of the Arctic Circle. There's simply no way that we can believe that we are prepared for these changes, and we have to radically rethink how our cities are organized in the face of climate change. And that may include, you know, redesigning many of the buildings. It may include redesigning the cities. It may include a sort of managed retreat from the coastlines.
And is this something that architecture generally has an appreciation of now, that its role will change as the world change and is forced to adapt and adjust to climate change? I mean, are we seeing, for example, use of different materials that have a smaller carbon footprint? Are we seeing new methods of design that are taking these realities into account?
Yes and no. I mean, I think there's certainly been progress made. Is it enough progress? A difficult question to ask me. I mean, for me, there's never enough progress. But I think that we have gotten more sophisticated in the last 30 years in terms of the materials that we select. I think the next evolution is in the sort of advocacy that architects do. The thing you hear most from architects is, well, I'm just an architect and my client wants this, so I'm going to design that. And I think what distinguishes, you know, an architect like Gasmin is that she's kind of gone out and said, this is the way the world needs to be. These are the people that are suffering. These are what their needs are. So this is what I'm going to design. So I think the next evolution for architects in terms of the way that they see the world is to join that global conversation about the better world that we all need, as opposed to fulfilling a sort of client service role.
Yasmin, how has the fallout from climate change affected your work?
Yeah, I think it's a very important question that you raised. And I have to say that the work that Eric is doing and the Curry Stone Foundation is supporting of social design is extremely important in all this, because that shows how many different people are trying to find different ways and charting out new courses as to how we can deal with climate change. And so what I feel is that first we've got to democratize architecture. There are too many people being star architects. We all trained to be star architects, actually. And we have to change that perception. We have to say, well, okay, fine, you want to design well, and certainly you want to have an ego, and every architect must have that. But then you have to also start dealing with that, what Esther has done, which is 98%, which in Pakistan is 99%. How do architects deal with the 99% of the population? And so unless we talk of democratizing architecture, we really can't do that. Secondly, I very firmly believe that we have to have it rooted in our vernacular traditions, in the heritage that every country possesses, because that is what resonates with the common people. And then low-cost and sustainable enterprises for people to take up. That itself creates a kind of local parallel economy in the area. And so you start really looking at non-engineered structures. You don't have to keep on building engineered structures. Because remember, everywhere where we have disasters, we go in and we build with alien models, which are largely based on concrete and steel, which actually add to the global warming and everything else, and with the carbon emissions. So we have to rethink the whole issue, and architects must take the lead in this. They are the best equipped to do it. So I always talk about this to young architects, to please, change the way that you look at things, change the way that you're working. And we must do that if we want to save the world.
Yasmin, what have you learnt from working with communities affected by poverty and natural disasters?
You know, the strange thing is that if they are poor and they are illiterate, but they are not really dumb. They are really quite smart, these people. And we need to really give them a helping hand. There's a recent project that we've been working on. It's called the Green Shelters Program, which is dealing with a community that is of beggars. They are mendicants. They go and beg at shrines next to Makli World Heritage, which is an amazing site. It's got lots of shrines as well as monuments. And since we worked there, so we decided to take them on. There's something like 3,000 men, women, and children that have transformed their lives, because we said to them, look, we'll give you these prefabricated bamboo structures for shelter, for toilet. We'll give you water. We'll give you stoves, the Pakistan Chula. But you have to do something in return for the community. So 1 month of voluntary work. And I cannot tell you how that's transformed their lives. They're all now earning. They are not begging anymore. They are planting trees, they're making kitchen gardens. So you just have to help them a little bit, and then they can take on. And it's costing only something like $250 per family to transform lives. It doesn't require much money at all.
And Eric, you, what do you think you've learned most from working in disaster zones?
A similar play on Yasmin's theme is that they're not that different than us. And, a disaster zone isn't much different than the city that you live in. The veneer of civilization is quite thin. I think that's what disaster teaches you. And that, once that's pulled away, what you find is, a fundamental goodness in people and a willingness to help one's neighbors and one's communities and that sort of thing. And I think that, disaster zones are horrible, horrible things. But at the same time, they kind of bring out the best in people. And that's what's always kept me going, is an understanding that, real humanity is there, and people set aside their differences and they work together. And as Yasmin stated, the poor aren't really that different from us. The difference between a poor beggar in Karachi and, a middle-class person in Melbourne is a lot of circumstance. So I think that fundamentally, what I've learned to do is to stop, I don't know how to put this term, othering the poor, stop considering them as a sort of, a different class of people that are somehow in need of my help, and rather just as, fellow human beings. And if I've got some resources that they need, then there's an exchange there.
Okay, great to talk to you. Thanks very much to both of you. A terrific conversation. Eric Kessel is Special Projects Director for the Curry Stone Foundation and a visiting lecturer at the University of California, Berkeley. And Yasmin Lurie is Pakistan's first female architect and co-founder of the Heritage Foundation of Pakistan. You can catch both speaking at the Humanitarian Architecture Week at RMIT University in Melbourne next week.